You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Dalia El-Sayed. Dalia, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is really great.
And are you in New York now, or where are you?
Yes, I'm in Long Island City, in Queens.
Okay. Very nice. Okay, so to begin with, I'd like to ask you about what you're working on now. I know your work is often research-oriented, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about what your current research or work is that you're involved in.
Sure. So I think if you walked into my studio right now, you would see a lot of backgrounds, sort of the underneath, the sort of underpainting of what's coming, and I'm sort of working on a whole bunch of those at one time, and then a bunch of books sort of tossed around, and then my sketchbooks. right now I'm sort of in a sort of testing out and research part, which involves a lot of reading and a lot of looking, and then also a lot of sort of testing. So that's what's going on right now. Some of the stuff that I've been working on is a continuation of prior work having to deal with, you know, these artificial landscapes or these created maps, but they've slightly been taking a turn to maybe something more urban as opposed to natural environment, and then they've started to get like a little weird with not necessarily references to the built environment, but more of these mounds and like weird platforms, like forced perspective. And sometimes sometimes when I look at them, I just think that they're more comical. And I mean that in two ways, both related to comics, but also funny. And the colors and stuff, these really bright colors and gradients sort of support that, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. So as you do this, and when you talked about books all around, are those art books or books that you're making?
Well, I do make books. Excuse me. I do make books, but so those are around. But the ones I'm talking about more are specifically art books. And like yesterday, I was looking at the G's Bend Quilts book, and I was also reading comics in the studio. So two of those things, I mean, they're so sort of separate, but yet they're sort of both informing in some way, either through color and pattern or through this idea of narrative and image being equal, you know, through the comics. Those things are happening. I mean, I'm strategic about it up to a certain point, and then another part of it or another part of me says, let the pleasure sort of pull you to the thing that is then going to turn into the research. But like the comics are pure pleasure, but I try to be official about them and say, oh yeah, they're totally related to my work.
What comics do you read? What is your pleasure?
Oh, well, I mean, I love narrative. And I think that, you know, in so many ways, I'm a avid reader. And so I love story. I also love like weird television soap operas. So I love this idea of an engrossing narrative. And the one I just started reading, Paper Girls, I think they're on issue two. I'm only on issue one, about girls who deliver newspapers in the 80s. I myself was a paper girl delivery person. So that one I was immediately drawn to. And then I finished reading Killing and Dying, which is on everyone's, you know, must-read list. And that was a really good one, too, much more sort of adult and sad in a way, but beautifully illustrated and great stories.
And those are all, those sound like independent comics, right? None of those are kind of major publishers, are they?
No, yeah, they're sort of like, you know, the Fantagraphics type of I don't know what they're on, but they're sort of that kind of like graphic novel / art-ish thing.
Yeah, well, it seems like a lot of artists create these things. I had never been to a Comic-Con before, and I went to one with my son, and, you know, I was expecting, you know, all this Spider-Man stuff everywhere, and what I was amazed by was a whole subsection of it, which was independent producers, and here are all these people, the artists sitting beside their small edition comics, making pretty amazing things. You know, that's a whole kind of subgenre in itself, it seems.
It is, and it's, you know, it's, I think I'm drawn to it. I'm drawn to it for two. I mean, I'm drawn to it obviously for the visual, but I'm also drawn to it for the literary aspect of it. It's a really concise way of telling a longer story, and the whole idea of there being, you know, breaks between panels and pauses and this condensed text, I think that's what's deeply connected to what I do as an artist. And so to think about how do you suggest and how do you give information that has to do with environment and internal environment as well as external environment, you know, in these small frames that then go on to make up this longer but still short collection. That's, I think, like the nut of it when I think about how it connects to what I'm doing in the studio.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that because, you know, when I look at, you know, your work on paper, as I've seen it, it does feel like there's narratives in there, there's stories, and everything that you're saying so far connects to that. But of course, it's also something very different than all the forms you've mentioned than comics. It's not so obvious what the read is in a paper like Wave of Waves or work on paper like you know Vapors and. You know, I have a sense of it, but it seems that there's so many elements that the viewer has to put together to complete the narrative. Is that correct, and is that what kind of you intend?
Yeah, that's totally spot on. I think that, you know, what I'm sort of thinking about a lot is the gaps between language. And you know, my background is in writing. My MFA is in fiction writing, and I was always sort of drawn to that path. It didn't really start to, I mean, the weird thing is that there's always been a visual component of it since I drew comics as a kid, like fourth grade, like seriously into comics with my sister passing them back and forth through school. But that part of my expression, I don't think I ever sort of allowed myself to think about as the product, right? I always thought about the writing part of it. And so, you know, through undergraduate and then graduate school, I was just convinced I was going to be a writer. But in the meantime, I did these like wacky doodles and, you know, funny drawings. And then at some point there was a shift there where I was like, I think the story is better told through the image and through these sort of abbreviated or, you know, very edited bits of language as opposed to the whole language. I love the sort of the space that created for the reader and now for the reader slash viewer to fill in. And it's all, that's just to me one of the interesting things about how, I mean, it's like poetry, you know, there's sort of, there's an odd line break and then there's a gap and then there's another word. And that space is so rich and so full of potential and so variable from person to person. And that's kind of the zone I love to toy around with.
Well, that sounds so much clearer now. That's very interesting. I didn't realize you had that background in writing, but then it makes more sense. Just as a poem leaves, you know, so many or so many bits of potentially a narrative unspoken for the viewer to fill in. Your paintings sound like they're occupying a similar kind of territory.
Yeah, and I write, I mean, the main, one of the sort of habitual ritual activities of my studio practice is writing on a typewriter. And so I start out with these half-page sort of rambling texts that then get, you know, edited and revised and sort of played with to become the small phrases. And so if there's any process that mirrors my studio practice, I think it's closest aligned with a poet, but I'm so like hesitant to call myself a poet with a capital P because that's a very, you know, refined territory. But I think what I'm doing in there is that's what I think that, you know, a poet would understand what's happening in there in terms of process. And then the visual comes later after. So I sort of have these collected bits and pieces and then I start to think about them, how they're going to sort of take shape or where they're going to lay on the paper. And then from there, the images sort of build around how I think it'll be read. Because the reading part is actually really important, too. And, you know, the placement of it just sort of goes from, you know, top to bottom, right to left. or actually left to right, the way that you would sort of, that's how I read them. I can't say that people don't come in and like jump in the middle and jump all around sometimes when there's multiple texts on a painting, but I sort of order them in a specific kind of way that I think I read them.
You know, it's interesting that you make that comment about poetry and the idea of calling yourself a poet or not, and the kind of rarefied territory that seems to be. I've interviewed a lot of poets, right, and I feel the same way. I feel like, you know, an artist can't really say work is poetic or I'm a poet, but most artists, visual artists, you know, including myself, feel like I could dabble in just about any visual medium and feel somewhat confident. But poetry seems to be like another realm. Now, when I say that to poets, you know, great ones, they say, oh, no, not at all. You know, poetry is, you know, they don't perceive it that way as this rarefied territory. And although this is slightly an aside, why do you think that is? Why do you think that's such rarefied territory and visual artists tend to think that way as well?
I mean, I think it's our whole cultural construct of what we think a poet is and does, which is this, you know, deep thinker and master of language. And I guess it's that mastery part that, you know, in everything, like, you know, when it comes to multiple different forms of art, right, like drawing or painting or whatever, performance, I feel like I can, even if I don't know how to do it, I can do it. You know what I mean? Like, I'll figure out a way to do it to get the sort of end result that I need. But I think with language, it's very intimidating. Maybe it's all of our, you know, scary grammar teachers from elementary school that are sort of in the back of our heads, and or our first introductions to poetry, which are always these classic texts that are so distant from current readers. You know, I think that's a part of it too. If we think about, like, you know, I think, what did you read as your first poem? Do you remember? Like, I mean, we had like Beowulf and things like that were so, that didn't connect to anything. So, I think...
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that is more the education. I mean, that's what one poet said. It was Bill Berkson. He said, you know, yeah, the education you received was poor. And even though I said, well, my mother read me amazing poems, but still, you don't... He said most teachers in schools, and he had spent a lot of time as poets in the schools in the 70s and in the 80s, he said, you know, teachers also don't know how to approach poetry and kind of are somewhat dismissive to move on to things that they understand more. But it's...
And I think it's with poetry. I think that everyone's, the way that I sort of learned to read poetry was that there was always this like mystery to be resolved, like, you know, riddled or figured out or whatever. That you know, and it's interesting to see some. You know, I'm going to mention teaching. Sometimes when I'm teaching, everyone always wants there to be an answer, and that can be really intimidating. If you look at something and there is no answer, that feeling of discomfort by not having something be so clear or saying this is this, this means this, that's not necessarily a pleasant sensation. So I think people tend to pull back, and I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right that people do tend to pull back. But at the same time, to come back to like the work you're working on now, it's being approached in a similar way, right? You're putting together these, in a sense, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of, you know, broken narratives, parts of narratives that are crafted in such a way that the viewer is understanding something in looking at the whole piece and understanding the kind of overtones of it all and the general sort of puzzle of it all. But there are all these kind of pieces that are missing, and I would imagine like personal iconography or personal references that you're making that we'll never know, right?
Yeah, I mean, I intentionally try to keep those out because I think that sometimes that kind of confessional, I mean, text art is funny because, you know, I sort of am uncomfortable with the whole confessional kind of stuff in art, like feelings, and so I think that there's layers of distance that I intentionally create so that, you know, if you don't ever see I or you or he or she, there's a general, you know, non-identified speaker, which, you know, the openness of that is on purpose, to sort of not have it be so, to not have its meaning be fixed, and to have it kind of stay possible for the viewer. And then of course there's the images, right? I mean, the sort of the whole idea of using any kind of map or landscape, which is so based in the voice of truth or the voice of accuracy, connected to this vague text, that leaves a puzzle that's sort of, you know, open as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And that is, you know, in a way, the art experience, or to me, the sort of poetic art experience. Maybe I'm overusing that term, but that we're all after, right? These moments of enough attention from the viewer that they're putting together, you know, a story or a narrative that's also different from yours, and not relating to something in particular, but largely to color, form, and composition.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not alone in this idea of connecting language and image, like that sort of, I'm super interested in that, and how a color, like you said, or a shape or a form can modify a word, and how a word can modify our interpretation or our viewing of something visual. That kind of simultaneous experience of two kinds of reading image and reading text for an English speaker, because my stuff is in English, but that's a rich place to think about what the order of it and how they overlap and how one sort of negates or confirms meaning.
That is, and where are the paintings currently being shown now? You're represented by a gallery, is that correct?
Well, I was showing at Robert Miller. I had a big installation there. I still have work available there. And right now there's 5 paintings from this like really recent series from the summer that are on display at the Sugar Hill Children's Museum. There's a show there about language and text. And it's this beautiful new museum on 155th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue that's, you know, this fabulous building. And so there's 5 of those. It's really interesting to see that, because there's 5 of the works sort of all together. And there's something nice about seeing them not isolated, you know. So it sort of brings this other kind of reading experience to it, because you're not only reading individual, and I work in series and I work in groups. I work on a couple of things at one time. So it's great to sort of see them together in that way.
That's interesting. And to move back a little bit, and when did you have your first show? Do you remember when that was? A visual art, or gallery show?
It was. I was in graduate school when I had my first. I was in a group show. That was like the sort of one of those pivotal shifts about switching my path. I mean, I had a great teacher at Columbia named Archie Rand, and he fully understood this thing about words and images. He himself worked with text all the time, and so I had this like wacky idea of like, oh, I want to make these things, and he was like 100% supportive, and he was just such an important teacher in my work. And by the time I was finishing graduate school and had to give in this novel-length thesis, I had already gotten work into like these shows that had to do with books. And I started out doing a lot of book stuff, like text shows and book shows, artist books. I had done like an internship at the Center for Book Arts. I was one of my jobs as an undergraduate was working at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, and my specific job there was to catalog the magazines and ephemera that would come in. And so we would get all these like wacky feminist magazines from around the world. And some of them were amazing. And they really, that was what sort of turned me on to the idea of making multiples and making books in the first place, in a distributable form. And so from there, I sort of got into the book world. And then, you know, it wasn't that long after that I just started showing. I'm trying to remember like what the first, I don't know if I had a first official show, but things started happening fast. And you know,
But the book world sounds like it was a little bit of a launch pad for you. I mean, I'm also familiar with the book world. What was happening in the quote unquote book world as you call it?
I think there was a lot of, I think I was coming off of this kind of like the end of punk rock in some way. And so there was this idea of you can just make things and send them out to people. And I used to mail things to people, make 20 of them and just mail them out to people. And then,
so that's almost like a zine it would be called then, or
right.
And so these are kind of copied on standard copy machines kind of things and bound cheaply.
Well, that would be the smart thing to do. I used to actually like hand paint them and stuff like that, and like make like a, you know, paintings on paper and then fold them up and put them into like this map fold and like put them in the U.S. mail and send them out. I was making books out of weird materials like metal and like sandpaper and sort of doing that. And then there was a period where I was trying to make things out of lead and make pages out of lead. And there was this kind of experimentation with form. And I think at some point I realized that the thing I was most interested in was the feeling of an open book and this sort of side by side and that kind of the motion of what we do when we have a spread in front of us, when you sort of look from page to page. And so then I started working exclusively in diptychs when I flipped to painting in the more traditional form. So I would, every painting I made had two panels and sometimes three panels and sometimes four panels, but it was all in direct reference to the idea of books.
And you said things started really taking off. I mean, I just love the idea and always have of sending books out to people just to respond to them. Were people responding to your books when you began first sending them out, which was very early in your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, people liked, I mean, people still like, I love getting mail. People liked getting things in the mail and they felt, you know, connected in some way. And then, I'm trying to think if there was like any direct, I don't know if there's like any direct correlation to like one thing following another, but it was just a general way of making friends and meeting people who were interested in similar things and, you know, sharing studio space and, you know, connecting with people in a world that I didn't really know anyone. I was really coming from the literary kind of place. And so all of a sudden, you know, I had more friends who were interested in art and I would go to see shows and go to see gallery things. And, you know, just, you know, sort of that part opened up. I had always been curious about art. I mean, you know, I can't say that I had friends who were practicing artists. And then that kind of shifted a little bit with getting out there and sort of meeting people who had like interests. And then I would just, you know, I sort of showed my work whenever and wherever I could. And that was really, you know, if you were having a weird like show in some kind of rec center, like I would be happy to participate. And I, you know, it started sort of going from that.
And when it started going from that, I mean, just to trace that trajectory to Robert Miller, which is a wonderful gallery, people just began noticing your work and inviting you to more shows, or how did things move forward after that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of like the, you know, if you look back and say like, what are these sort of key moments? Like one of the key moments was I had a wacky show in the rec center in South Orange, New Jersey, where I forget how I even got that show. Like I think I just mailed them slides in that day, and they offered me like a little show with like not, you know, like they don't pay for anything, but they would pay for a postcard. And so I had a postcard made, and then I sent that postcard out and they sent the postcard out, and that postcard ended up on the desk of somebody who worked at the Jersey City Museum, Rocio Aranda, who was a curator there, who really liked the work and ended up pinning it up on her desk. And, you know, like a year later, she had some other show that was coming up and thought it was right. So she included my work in that. And then like a year after that, I had a solo show at the Jersey City Museum, which was, you know, is now closed, but it was a really great contemporary art museum. And then I had a review in the New York Times from that show. And so that's how those things started coming. And then I had done residencies where you meet people and then people think of you. And so that's how that network sort of expanded. And so, and you know, I still apply for things all the time, residencies and things like that, and I still get rejected. So it's not like this like light switch goes off and suddenly everything you want is yours, but suddenly there were more opportunities, and those opportunities very luckily have continued to sort of grow. And, you know, one thing kind of always connects to the next thing, and then when you think, oh, nothing's happening, all of a sudden a few things happen. I also keep a list of every rejection and every acceptance, like this insane Microsoft Excel worksheet.
Just for your own records? Or, I mean, that's kind of a wonderful thing to do.
I started doing it for my own records to sort of keep track of things and say, like, oh, you know, this application, McDowell, is coming up. Like, oh, I'll just make sure I keep that on my radar or whatever. And then I ended up keeping the results. And so it's this long document of, you know, of basically like the statistical reality of, you know, applications. Like, you know, you submit 10, you get one. You sometimes you get three or four in a row, and then sometimes you get like a whole slew of rejections. And so it's good to look at that when I look back at it and think, like, okay, first of all, it's a real testament to the labor, like the hidden labor of art, where you're actually doing your own everything to sort of, you know, you're writing about how your work is going to affect the audience when you haven't even made the work yet. So that, like, that insane kind of climate that we live in. But also just all that kind of labor that it takes to, I don't have like, you know, an army of studio assistants. I have people who help me on certain projects, but I don't have people full time like doing all that kind of stuff for me. So it's actually, it's a lot of work. And it's visualized in that spreadsheet.
I love that. you know, it's just a nice way to keep track of all that, because we tend to want to like forget the rejections and emphasize we're accepted. And it's nice to see what the ratio is. Do you know what it is for you? Is there a kind of 1 in 10 thing or anything that you've quantified over the years?
I always joke that it's 1 in 10. I actually have never really measured if it's 1 in 10, because I think what happens is that you end up getting, you know, 9 rejections, and then like then you get an acceptance, and you get another rejection, then you get 3 acceptances. You know what I mean? So right. I show this the spreadsheet during, although I don't really share it publicly, but I do show it when I give lectures at art schools, because just sort of to support what you said, you know, we have an amazing visiting artist lecture program at the school I teach in, and the artists have been great and really honest about talking about their work. But often you go to see somebody talk and it's just this, like, you know, the golden child, like, oh, the, you know, some kind of fairy dust fell on their head, and there's no recognition or admission of all things that didn't work out. And I know we don't really think about them in that context when we're giving a talk, but that really is a part of it. And I think the reason why it's so important is it also relates to the way you approach your studio practice. And for me, you know, there's amazing flows. There's like deep, this summer was one of them. I felt like I was like in college again. I was just like nonstop, like late at night painting, like, you know, 8 hours, going to like take a little nap, coming back and painting like in this furious, frenetic kind of way. And then there's other times where it's like real slow going, and all of the things that you know are false but feel like are really true, you feel at that moment like, oh, my God, I'm never going to make a painting again, or what, you know, you have all that sort of doubt that comes up. And that's just, I think that's such a real part of working at your studio practice. You know, I mean, it's sort of a real part of it. And so in some way, the applications and rejections replicate that cycle of fits and starts and, you know, forward thrusts and tiny motions backward, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. That makes sense. And in closing, where can people, I mean, people are listening to this from different parts of the world, but also a lot of people within distance of New York, where can they see your show? There'll be links in this article to your website, but is there anywhere in particular you want to point people to see more of your work?
I mean, they can always go to Robert Miller Gallery, which has a bunch of work there that's not on display but available at the gallery. And then there's the current show at the Sugar Hill Children's Museum, which is up through, I think, the end of February. It's a really great show called Text. And then I have, some work now at Untitled in Miami, if anyone's down there and they want to It's the Brodsky Center. I have a print down there, and I think that, you know, and then, of course, on my website, which is the way a lot of people look at work today.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciated your interview and what you're talking about in terms of your work and also your process. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really nice to talk to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.